Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Thursday, April 7, 2016. The SPLM-IO has new excuses for the delayed arrival of its leader to Juba.
The Vice President Designate, Dr. Riek Machar, is scheduled to arrive in Juba on the 18th of April because there are some arrangements by the leadership. He wants to make further briefings with the top military leadership.
And MSF says South Sudan is facing critical nationwide drug shortage.
I saw with my own eyes an empty primary health center. Nothing, no drugs in Aweil East. I spent the day with our outreach nurse. We went to four primary health care centers. In three of them, zero drugs.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The arrival of first Vice President Designate Riek Machar in Juba has been delayed by another 6 days to allow time for what an opposition official calls technical arrangements. The Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission, or JMAC, had proposed that Machar arrive on Tuesday. The government has criticized the delay, as we hear from Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
JMAC's proposed timetable had Riek Machar arriving on April 12th. But his spokesman, James Gadet Duck, says that date has been pushed back to April 18th.
The first Vice President Designate, Dr. Riek Machar, is scheduled to arrive in Juba on the 18th of April because there are some arrangements by the leadership. He wants to make a further briefing with the top military leadership in Baghdad, and also he wants to ensure that his other officials around the world arrive in Juba or he could arrive.
JMAC's Deputy Chief of Staff says JMAC Chief Festus Mogai was unable to comment on the change of the date for Machar's arrival. JMAC is in charge of making sure that the peace agreement is fully implemented and the permanent ceasefire is adhered to. JMAC had earlier indicated that the Transitional National Assembly would be inaugurated a week from today and the ministers of the Transitional Government of National Unity would be appointed on April 14th, followed by the first meeting of the Council of Ministers of the Transitional Government on April 15th. Machar's delayed arrival means that is not likely to happen next week. Government spokesman Michael Makwe says JMAC has a lot to explain.
We have been waiting for him so that the Tigono is established. And if he delays, then it is a setback. This is all that we can say. But it is JMAC that will give us the answer as to why. Because they are the ones who set the agenda. They set the program for his coming. And if the program was set by them, then they will be the ones also to tell us as to why is it amended.
According to the peace agreement signed in August last year, South Sudan's warring parties were to form a transitional government 3 months from the signing of the peace agreement. Even before the announcement of Machar's delayed return to Juba, the two sides were far behind schedule. Disagreements over cantonment areas for the armed opposition forces have also delayed the implementation of the peace agreement. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
A U.S.-based advocacy group is educating South Sudanese about the contents of the August peace agreement. Democracy International officials say they believe once citizens are informed about what is in the deal, they will own it and support its implementation. For VOA News, Abraham Agot reports from Awil.
Democracy International is implementing the U.S.-funded systems to uphold the credibility and the constitutionality of the elections in South Sudan. The group wrapped up a 2-day campaign in Awil today aimed at creating awareness about the peace agreement. Democracy International Education Officer Caroline Kibos says they want to bring the peace message to everyone in South Sudan.
Taught them about the peace agreement and how they can continue disseminating the peace further. generally, this is just a way of telling everyone about the peace agreement, because we notice that not everyone in South Sudan knows about the peace agreement. Only very few people know about this peace agreement.
Kibo says the South Sudanese themselves are the only people who can bring about an end to the conflict.
We think that if knowledge is power. So if people are aware, if you equip people with that knowledge, believe by equipping the whole community about this knowledge, they will help us to implement the peace agreement itself. Because right now, this peace agreement is not being implemented.
Local civil society activist Mayuol Ding Mayuol agrees. He says more people need to learn about the content of the peace deal.
People have been talking about peace, but many, and those concerned, those who should hear about peace have never got access to hear about the signed peace. So today we have taken this opportunity to tell our people, to tell the chiefs, to tell the youth, the women, and all about the signed peace between the government and the SPLM. Many people are informed about the peace. This is going to be reflected in the attitudes of many people, and I think it will be a very positive impact.
Elizabeth Nyanut Henry, a resident who attended the briefing, says like many other residents, she did not know what the agreement requires South Sudan's leaders to do. She says she is now well equipped to explain the agreement to other residents. Nyanut says women in particular should feel empowered to spread the word about what is in the agreement, since they are bore the brunt of the war.
We have many ways. When we are grouping, we can talk about peace. When they are in hand pump, fetching water, they will talk about peace. My message to the women, we must start our peace from our home, to our neighbors.
Democracy International says it will hold similar campaigns in other counties and Payam across the country to enable citizens to learn and ask questions about the contents of the peace agreement. For VOA News, I am Abraham Agoth reporting in a wheel.
Today is International Day for Commemoration of the Rwandan Genocide. Every year, from the 7th to 13th of April, people around the world remember the 1994 genocide. More than 800,000 Tutsi and Hutus were killed in a span of 100 days. Today in Juba, hundreds of Rwandans and their friends paid tribute to those who died. One senior official says South Sudanese can learn lessons of forgiveness and tolerance from the tragedy that occurred in Rwanda. Mungume Debs Rakarinj has more for VOA from Juba.
John Bosco Kalisa, chairperson of the Rwandan community in South Sudan, says besides paying tribute to the hundreds of thousands who died in 1994, the day is meant to remind the world that genocide can happen anywhere in the world.
The genocide has no boundaries. It can happen anywhere. It's not only that happened in Rwanda, but it can happen anywhere. So this commemoration says that we need to condemn the acts of genocide. It can happen through racial discrimination, segregation, marginalization of any group of society.
The theme of this year's commemoration is Kwibuka 22, Fighting Genocide Ideology. Kwibuka is a Kinyarwanda word meaning to remember. Kalisa says the theme calls on people around the world to fight any genocidal ideology that might be forming in their communities.
It also falls on us to teach and pass on this responsibility to the youth, our friends and neighbors, that unity and reconciliation are key determinants for social and economic progress.
Speaking at the same event, Mustafa Sumari, the deputy special representative to the United Nations Secretary General in South Sudan, agrees.
To prevent such atrocities, we must always strive for inclusivity. We must manage issues of identity in a constructive, peaceful manner. Prevention should be a continuous process from the community to national level. Preventing genocide means establishing legitimate and accountable national institutions that are inclusive and credible in the eyes of the population.
Bashir Bandi, South Sudan's Deputy Minister for Foreign Affairs, says South Sudan is inspired by Rwanda's progress after the genocide. He says now that the conflict has come to an end, South Sudan will work towards uniting its people.
The peace agreement provides room for accountability, for transparency, for good governance, for reconciliation. the experience of the Gashacha course is embedded in our African tradition. And I think in South Sudan, where we have about 64 ethnic groups, we want to learn from Rwanda, which has three, so that we embrace nationalism and national identity.
Under the Rwanda's Gachacha system, communities at the local level elected judges to hear trials of suspects in the genocide. Band says the courts were more lenient in sentencing if a person was repentant and sought to reconcile with the community.
We want to learn how perpetrators and victims of the genocide were able to reconcile through the Gachacha courts, because the essence of reconciliation is admittance of guilt and acceptance of responsibility. You have demonstrated it, and I think this is a pride for us. It's not only a pride for Rwanda, but a pride for the whole of Africa.
Aid agencies say tens of thousands of people have been killed, some of them on the basis of their ethnicity, in South Sudan's two-year conflict. The United Nations says acts of human rights atrocities, including murder, rape, and torture, have been committed by forces on both sides of the conflict. Juba resident William Gifulu says one lesson he learned from today's commemoration is to avoid discrimination.
Every place where you go, the first question that you ask it is your name and from where you are coming from. And this is what the people of South Sudan is needing, to reunite themselves and know themselves are from one country.
For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Ruakarinj in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Darfur, where a confidential report by United Nations Security Council panel of experts has implicated the leader of a militia in Darfur of taking part in a scheme to pocket more than $50 million a year from gold sales at Jebel Amir in northern Darfur. Musa Hilal, the leader of the Al-Musawa Revolutionary Council, says the UN report is not true. Speaking in Arabic, Hilal denies owning any gold companies in Jebel Amir.
What was said in the report is not true. I have no connection with mining in Jebel Amir. The mining business activities are limited to private sector, from local Sudanese as well as from neighboring countries. The number of the participants from private sector are larger and amounts to around 40 to 50,000 individuals. I have no business connection with them, though.
Hilal was the leader of the notorious Janjaweed militia group, which was accused of killing scores of civilians and raping several women in Darfur. Under UN Resolution 1672 in 2006, the UN Security Council sanctioned Hilal and three other individuals, freezing their assets and imposing an international travel ban. Hilal returned to Darfur in 2013 and after holding a prominent post as special advisor to Ministry of Federal Affairs in Khartoum. Since his return, Hilal defected from the ruling National Congress Party and founded Al-Sawaha Revolutionary Council, an umbrella organization that Hilal hopes to register as a legitimate political party. Russia blocked the release of the report, saying it lacks key details on the Sudanese gold trade. Russia has also refused to extend the contract of the UN panel of experts on Sudan. Musa Hilal says there is no proof of allegations made against him in the UN report and points out that he has not been to Darfur for a long time.
$54 million is not a small sum of money. If I had it, it would have been obvious in my financial transactions and way of living. A huge sum of money like that would not be hidden easily. I believe that the report did me injustice. Since it is a false report, I want those who submitted the report to the Security Council to reveal the source of such information.
Hilal is threatening to sue the UN Security Council in the International Court for tarnishing his image.
I see that report is contradictory to the truth. If there is an international original law that governs this, I will take it upon myself to file a lawsuit against whoever published that false report.
In 2012, hundreds of people were killed in Darfur as two communities of Resigat and Salamat in Jebel Amir fought over control of the gold mines in the area. Back then, Hilal says he traveled to Jebel Amir to reconcile warring communities in the area.
My only connection with the problems that took place in Jebel Amir was only limited to mediate and reconcile disagreements between the tribesmen and the private sector miners in 2012. My mediation was according to the common law and traditions followed in the area. I have no permanent presence in Jebel Amir, but if problems arise, we send committees there to resolve them.
Before the government enlisted Hilal to lead the Janjaweed in 2003, he was serving a prison sentence for bank robbery after being arrested for the murder of 17 people. Gold has become an increasingly vital source of national wealth for Sudan's economy, particularly after South Sudan separated from Sudan and declared its independence in 2011, taking with it most of the oil fields. Unregulated gold mining has emerged as a major source of revenue for Darfur's armed groups. Between 2010 and 2014, more than $4.5 billion worth of gold was smuggled from Sudan into the United Emirates, according to the UN Panel of Experts report. This report was prepared by VOA fellow Nadia Taha. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, people in Western Equatoria say they cannot stop eating bushmeat. Find out why.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what distracts you most at school or at work?
At school, what distracts me most is irresponsibility. You know, women have an art of taking care of everyone. When you are in the school and you have a responsibility, it is very hard to concentrate on what you are doing.
Honestly, what distracts me so much is when I come to office and I cannot find anything doing, I feel disturbed. I always want to be engaged.
Okay, me, noise. I don't like noise. And secondly, my phone. It's really a distraction.
Let's take, for example, for the past 1 week, I've been distracted most with the issue of the current economical issues in Nigeria. I'm always thinking, when are we going to come out of this?
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The French medical charity Médecins Sans Frontières says South Sudan is running out of life-saving medicine. MSF says this shortage comes 1 year after international donors stopped funding life-saving medical projects in South Sudan, known as the Emergency Medicines Fund. SIN Bureau reports international NGOs in South Sudan who rely on this project to deliver medicine to vulnerable populations have little to no options to help their patients.
The Emergency Medicines Fund was created in 2013 as a mechanism to help international humanitarian groups deliver medical aid to people in need around South Sudan. It was designed as a county-by-county project funded by international aid donors designed to give medical NGOs the ability to handle the medical needs of their assigned country. The Emergency Medicines Fund, or EMF, expired in May of last year, which was about the same time that South Sudan's Ministry of Health was supposed to take over. The conflict that began in 2013, however, disrupted that progress, and the government, which was in far worse shape at the end of the program, was unable to fund the project. Mike White is MSF's Deputy Operations Manager for South Sudan. He says the decision by donors to not extend the EMF has put many lives in danger.
We're talking about anti-malarial drugs, we're talking about respiratory tract drugs, and we're talking about diarrheal drugs. And these are the four leading mortalities in South Sudan, and these are the drugs that people need in order to live.
White says the program was originally designed to last 2 years, where local governments could build their capacity to assist their own people. But he says the decision to stop funding the Emergency Medicines Fund without providing a viable solution means people are going to die.
I mean, I saw it with my own eyes. An empty primary health center, nothing, no drugs. In Awil East, I spent the day with our outreach nurse. We went to four primary health care centers. In three of them, zero drugs.
White says the ongoing conflict has blocked the efforts of aid workers trying to supply health care to patients. But the real problem, he says, is that there is no more emergency fund for medical supplies in South Sudan.
You know, these are places in western Equatoria, in northern Bahr-Ghazal. I mean, these have been relatively stable environments throughout the last 2 years. So we can't use the ongoing or prolonged conflict in South Sudan here as an excuse. The reason that there are no drugs in these places is because people have taken decisions to discontinue a program that was saving people's lives without any viable solution.
MSF does not work directly with the Emergency Medicines Fund. White says his team in South Sudan works independently to supply and pay for their own drugs, and they run their own supply logistics. He says there are NGOs in South Sudan who are directly affected by the termination of the EMF. Ayan Bior, VOA News, Washington.
A top wildlife official in Budue State says his officers have arrested dozens of suspected poachers in the area in the last few months. Brigadier General Jonathan Nyari says his forces are working to combat the illegal killing of wild animals in former Western Equatoria State. Gift Friday reports for VOA from Yambio.
Speaking in Arabic, Brigadier General Nyari told reporters at a news conference in Yambio last night his forces arrested nearly 50 suspected poachers. Starting from January up to today, April 5th, we have arrested from Meridi to Tombra 48, and 48 cases are opened. 5 rifles were arrested and were brought, and we have filed the cases. Nyari says the suspects will be charged according to South Sudanese laws. Anyone who killed an elephant has already killed a human being. If the law says someone who killed a human being be sentenced for 20 years, you will also be sentenced for 20 years. Nyari says he believes each of the suspected poachers is likely to be sentenced to more than a year in prison, depending on the offences committed. Yambio resident Bazo Robert believes it is wrong for wildlife officers to arrest suspected poachers. He says the decision will deny residents the right to hunt for bushmeat, something they rely on for food.
So I feel so bad about it because now I will not eat meat, only cassava leaves, which is our common food here in our Zanderland. We don't have cows. How to bring cows from their places up to here, and to bring them, it costs a lot of money compared to the inflation now in the country. So this dry meat they sell, it makes us benefit.
Robert appeals to local wildlife authorities to release the suspected poachers, whom he says are local residents simply looking for a source of livelihood. He says the government should educate people across the country on the importance of conserving wildlife before it arrests suspected poachers, some of whom, he says, may not know they are breaking the law. Another Yambio resident, Anabati Susan, does not see it that way. Susan says South Sudanese should preserve wildlife, enforce the laws, and promote tourism just as other countries do.
If you go in a place like Kampala, they are earning incomes from their zoos, from their game parks. When the tourists come in, you can earn a lot of money from the wild animals. Because here we don't have zoo. We would have gathered those wild animals and we put them in one place so that we earn income from them.
Nyari agrees with Susan, saying the area's protected wildlife could become a big tourist attraction in South Sudan.
Poaching should stop because this is one of our incomes. Our economy will be on those animals for the country. If we only rely on the oil, in some years to come, the well will dry up, but the animals will still be there.
Due to rampant poaching in the area, Nyari says thousands of wild animals are fleeing to neighboring Democratic Republic of Congo and the Central African Republic. For VOA News, I'm Gift Friday in Yambio.
The You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Dam.
Thanks, John. Riek Machar won't be arriving in Juba until April 18th. The first vice president designate's arrival is being delayed by another 6 days to allow time for what the opposition calls technical arrangements. The Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission proposed that Machar arrive on April 12th. SPLM-IO spokesman James Gadot-Dak says the date has been pushed back to April 18th because Machar wants to hold more briefings with the top military leadership in Pagak, and he also wants to ensure that other SPLM-IO officials arrive in Juba before he does. JMEC's deputy chief of staff says JMEC chief Festus Mohai was unavailable to comment on the change of date for Machar's arrival in the capital. JMEC had earlier indicated that the Transitional National Assembly would be inaugurated a week from today, and the ministers of the Transitional Government of National Unity would be appointed on April 14th. Now those dates are unclear. A U.S.-based advocacy group is educating South Sudanese about the contents of the August peace agreement signed by both sides. Democracy International officials say they believe once citizens are informed about what is actually in the deal, they will own it and support its implementation. Democracy International is implementing the U.S. aid-funded systems to uphold the credibility and constitutionality of elections in South Sudan. The group wrapped up a two-day campaign in Awil today aimed at creating awareness about the peace agreement. Democracy International Education Officer Caroline Kibos says they want to bring the peace message to everyone in South Sudan. And finally, today is International Day for Commemoration of the Rwandan Genocide. Every year, from the 7th to the 13th of April, people all over the world remember the 1994 genocide. More than 800,000 Tutsis and Hutus were killed in a span of 100 days. In Juba, hundreds of Rwandans and their friends paid tribute to those who died. One senior official says South Sudanese can learn lessons of forgiveness and tolerance from the tragedy that occurred in Rwanda. John Bosco Kalisa, chairperson of the Rwandan community in South Sudan, says besides paying tribute to the hundreds of thousands who lost their lives in 1994, the day is meant to remind the world that genocide can happen anywhere in the world through racial discrimination and segregation. The theme of this year's commemoration is Kiwibuka 22, Fighting Genocide Ideology. Kiwibuka is a Kinyarwanda word meaning to remember. South Sudanese officials say the lessons of tolerance and reconciliation can be learned from Rwanda in South Sudan. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Dam.
That's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Sudan Mojahja by Gordon Kong.
Belena, Sudana, Belena, 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 Taban, Mindraman, Yarokuna, Taliju Payana, Belena, Mamurta, Sudan, Mujaja, Mafira, Lena, Talna, Baiti.
We have been listening to Gordon Kong with the song Sudan Mujahja. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for tuning in. We hope to see you back here tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.